And of course, as many of you know, Diana Hanbury King. And I'm not sure if she's here yet. Is Diana here yet? She was touring her family around campus. She has family who's come in from literally all over the world, I believe, to come celebrate. Diana? She's on her way? Soon, okay. So and as you know, this weekend is a celebration of what our founders have given to us here at Kildonan. You know, what they started back in 1969. And as you know, this year in particular, with Diana retiring, when she came and made this announcement, you know, everybody was in shock. They said, "Diana, you're so young and you're retiring. That's so unfair." But we knew it was coming. And she said one thing. She said, "You know, I don't want this to be a sad time. I want this to be an exciting time, because this is not about things ending. It's about things beginning again." And she said, "So I want it to be called something special." And she decided, "Well, I want it to be called Onward," which I think is really fitting. And so that was Diana's. That's what she asked for. And so the next question we asked her was, "Well, you know, Diana, we want to do something for you. What would you like?" And we talked about that. And we had a great committee that got together under Maureen Rule, one of our elementary parents, and put together a great shindig that we're going to have tonight. And we said, "Is there anybody you want to have there to speak on your behalf?" And she said, "Well, I must have one person." She said, "That is Peter Wright." Now, I don't know if you know who Peter Wright is, but he's a pretty famous guy. You know, this is somebody, and for those of you who know what Carter Funding is, this is the guy that made Carter Funding possible. He's an amazing guy. And I had heard Peter speak before, and I said, "Geez, Diana," I said, "you know, that's great. I would love to get Peter Wright here. The parents would love to have him here, but Peter Wright, he's so busy. This is a busy guy." She goes, "I will get him here. He will come." So you know what? I said, "All right." And the rest of us in the room were like, "Oh, geez, I hope this comes through. You know, we're gonna bank on this guy being here." Sure enough, you know, he did what he was told. And if you've ever been tutored by Diana Hanbury King, you know, I don't care if it was 10 years ago or 40 years ago, you come when she calls me. You don't say no to Diana Hanbury King. So Pete Wright, I had the opportunity to hear him speak on Diana's behalf at the Connecticut Association of Children with Learning Disabilities about 8 years ago. And I think you're in for a real treat here. He's had an amazing career, but he also had an amazing experience with Diana Hanbury King. And so I would like to invite Pete Wright up to the stage now to begin a dedication to Diana.
I have to tell you, when Diana called me and asked me to do this, where is Diana? When she called me on the telephone and asked me to do this, I mean, you don't ever say no to Diana. But at the same time, I'll share with you all those memories and those fears just kicked in. Emotionally, it was like, what did I agree to do? To come here and to talk with you all is one, and to come up with some remarks is really one of the more difficult tasks I have encountered. And I've encountered a lot of things where I've got to get up before a panel of judges or whatever else and say a few words and convince them of this and that. But this has been especially difficult for me because it's emotional. And why is it emotional? Because next to my mother and my father, that woman right there is responsible for my being here today and being able to accomplish what I've accomplished. If it wasn't for Diana Hanbury King, I would have not amounted to much of anything but another kid in D.C. who went the wrong way down the tracks and ended up maybe in a lot of trouble or whatever else, because that was certainly where I was headed. So then I said to myself, as I was dealing with the emotions of how am I going to handle this, and how am I going to come up with something that's coherent and makes sense and is kind of motivational and whatever, and end of I know. And I really wrestle with, how am I going to do this? And I always tell my parents, when you are negotiating with the school system, you got to put stuff in writing with nice thank you letters. And then when you're requesting a due process hearing, you got to tell a story that makes the reader feel the pain and come around from the other side of the table onto your side. And how do you do that? By telling a story using visual imagery. And you don't start at the end first. You start at the beginning of time, chronologically, and tell the story. So how can I tell the story chronologically? Well, I guess it goes back to probably in the 1920s with Dr. Samuel T. Orton. That's where it began. And Dr. Orton was the premier medical doctor who did autopsies of brains and learned about how the brain works with regard to very localized areas of language. He ended up joining forces with Anna Gillingham, and they created the approach known as the Orton-Gillingham approach. All the while, Diana was being raised in England, and her home was a cottage called Dunnebeck, named after a river that flowed by the grounds. And Diana, you know, didn't have it so easy herself as a youngster. No silver spoon for her. She attended 10 schools by the time she was 16. And just to read some of the stories as to what happened and the dynamics, it will bring some tears to your eyes. Then later, she ended up in Africa, and she was doing some tutoring with some children, and that was when she began working with kids and teaching them reading, writing, arithmetic, and spelling. Was when she kind of got hooked in working with kids and tutoring, and had this one kid, and she was tutoring the kid in math, and she said, draw a line that is 3 inches long. And this was the instruction in the math book. And so she came over to check on the student's work, and the student had drawn a picture of a lion. What are you doing? A lion? You're supposed to draw a line 3 inches long. This is a line. That's what it said. And she realized there's something else going on here. So that was kind of, I guess, really one of the first things, I think, that hit her. And then she ended up at a school called the Ruzawi School and began working with a number of other youngsters. And then eventually she ended up living with her uncle Mike. And Mike had two daughters, Yvonne and Ashley. She didn't realize it at the time, but they were severely dyslexic. She didn't know really about dyslexia, but was discovering some unusual characteristics and traits. And what was the name of that farm in Africa? Kildonan. Uncle Mike's farm was named Kildonan. So that was going on, and Diana was already an avid sailor, and she ended up traveling to America. And on the ship crossing over, the captain of the ship discovered that she was an avid sailor and that she could shoot the stars. In other words, she knew how to use a sextant and bring down the planets of the sun and the moon to the horizon and figure out their location in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, whether they're on course or not. And they ended up doing it 4 times a day. Diana King working with the captain of the ship coming across to America. So that was quite a story. She ended up in Washington, D.C. and began working at Sidwell Friends School. And while there, she was working under Helene Durbrow. And at that school where she was working, Anna Gillingham came. And I'm going to read a little excerpt from her book. Diana explains, and this is in Diana's book, One by One. And Trish, I believe you have copies of that for sale over here. In the book, she said that once a week, Helene Durbrow met with teachers of each grade. There were two classes at each level, which included grades 5 through 8. Miss Gillingham's visits were always intimidating. I remember her as a heroic figure, always dressed in black, given to epigrammatic pronouncements such as, "What the teacher hasn't taught, the child doesn't know." And in response to questions about pacing, "Go as fast as you can and as slow as you must." Then, at one point when Anna Gillingham was invited to speak to a group of teachers at a school, at the end of her lecture, she asked for questions, and one teacher raised her hand and asked a question, and Anna Gillingham said, "Young lady, if you had been paying attention to what I said, you would not need to ask that question." Needless to say, there were no further questions. Helene Durbro was terrified of Anna Gillingham. You know, as I read that, then I said, you know, those were the roots of Diana. That was Diana. I remember I was at a conference when Diana received an award from the Orton Dyslexia Society, and I was at a banquet table, and someone was up there talking about Diana's history and what her accomplishments were, and then Diana was getting ready to get up, and as Diana got up, a lady was seated next to me, and she did not know who I was or my relationship with Diana, and she said to me, "You know, I was taught by her about 10 years ago, and even now as I see her walk up to the podium, I get nervous and scared." My God. And then she began to tell me stories, and the anxiety, the tremor in her voice, but the love and the admiration for Diana, just it was awesome for me to hear that. So continuing on, she ended up at Sidwell Friends. And then she, during the summertime, she worked with under Helene Durbro at the camp up in Vermont, Camp Mansfield. She did that for 3 summers. And then around 1952, Diana King began tutoring me. And I'll tell you more about that later. I'm going to jump back in time. I'm going to take it out of the chronological order. But first, continuing with Diana, she then founded Camp Dunnebeck in 1955. Now, in the meantime, with regard to the legal state of education in the United States, that was in 55 with Camp Dunnebeck being founded around then, plus or minus a year or so. In 1965, there was a landmark piece of legislation passed in Congress called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, in which the federal government began providing money, funds to public schools. Then in 1968, quote, "There came yet another miracle. In the summer of 1968, on Parents' Day, in the middle of the camp, Kurt Goldman, father of one of the campers, approached me. He said, 'Now, about that school you've talked about wanting to start, you go ahead with your plans, and I'll take care of the finances.' I was touched and thought to myself, 'What a lovely man.' And then I promptly forgot about his offer, because I could not imagine that he meant it." Again, we thank you for not everybody can see you there. Now, locations changed over the years for Dunnebeck and for Kildone, and Kildone eventually began in 1970. And then, from a legal perspective, in 1975, Congress passed the Education for All Handicapped Children Act. It was also known as Public Law 94-142. That law went into existence. In 75 because of two cases that had happened in 72. And there was a case in Pennsylvania called PARC, Pennsylvania Association for Retarded Citizens. If you were a child in a wheelchair in Pennsylvania, you are not allowed to attend school if they did not have ramps or elevators. By state statute, if your IQ was below a certain number, using the formula that IQ equals mental age divided by chronological age times 100, if it was below a specific number, by state statute, you were not allowed to attend school. The litigation around that, the judicial decisions upheld the statute, making a finding that it was a waste of taxpayer dollars to try to educate children who were feeble-minded.
Yeah.
I mean, that was the language in the judicial decisions. And then another case came out, the Park case itself, and they attacked it directly head-on and ended up changing the state statute and providing education to the children in Pennsylvania. Simultaneously, a case out of Washington, D.C., called the Mills case. If you were a child in Washington, D.C., and you had some form of disabilities, without regard to that, change the facts. If you were a child in Washington, D.C., and you were taken away from your parents because your parents neglected, abused you, or abandoned you, you were placed into the custody of the D.C. Children's Home. D.C. Children's Home had a number of children who had disabilities. D.C. Public Schools told D.C. Children's Home, we cannot afford to educate those children. That's your responsibility. You have to do that. And that was a sister agency that told D.C. schools, told D.C. Children's Home, we cannot educate these children. But now the only question is, every state had a law mandating compulsory school attendance. So how could the school systems evade their own statute? Because they made a finding that the child was expelled because the kid had a disability, or the child was suspended indefinitely. So by using the labels of expulsion and suspension without regard to a child's behavior, but because of the child's status, the children were not allowed to attend school. So that was the nature of the law around the country in 72. Those two cases came out in 72. Congress did a big investigation in 75, said, you've got to educate these children. And one of the very first principles in the opening part of the statute about states' responsibilities is that each state, in order to receive federal money, has to provide a free, appropriate public education to all children, even children who are suspended or expelled. So they made that very clear right in the beginning of the statute. So that was the developments in 1975. And what I have got up on screen is the dedication page of this book. Our first edition was about the special ed law of 97. This edition here is the second edition, ID 2004. And the dedication reads that we dedicate this book to Diana Hanbury King and Roger Saunders, who taught Peter how to read, write, spell, and do arithmetic. That's the dedication of this book. Now, I'm going to take you to a couple pages in this book just to give you a sense as to what the law is. So bear with me for a moment. I want to tell you what is the most important statute in this book. What's the purpose of the law? It's in 1400 subsection D. I know that most of you will not be able to see this, but basically what it says is the purposes of this title are to ensure that all children with disabilities have available to them a free, appropriate public education that emphasizes special education and related services designed to meet their unique needs and prepare them for further education, employment, and independent living. So that's the purpose of the law, to prepare children for further education, employment, and independent living. And then I'm going to jump you to another page. I won't put it up on screen because it'll be too hard to read. It'll be just too small. But the term learning disability is defined in the statute. And what it says is that the term specific learning disability means a disorder in one or more of the basic psychological processes involved in understanding or in using language spoken or written, which disorder may manifest itself in the imperfect ability to listen, think, speak, read, write, spell, or do mathematical calculations. Disorders included. Such term includes such conditions as perceptual disabilities, brain injury, minimal brain dysfunction, dyslexia, and developmental aphasia. In other words, in 1975, this law had, under the heading of LD, dyslexia, the word dyslexia. And even today, I will have school districts, school psychologists, directors especially, will tell me, well, you know, dyslexia is not covered by special ed. Well, we don't do that. It's a medical issue. That comes up from time to time. It's been in the statute since 1975. Now, it also made reference to minimal brain dysfunction. That was the label that was used at that time. I'll tell you more about that in just a moment. So that was 1975. Then next significant development was in 19, for our purposes today, is in 1993, I represented Shannon Carter before the U.S. Supreme Court. This is a picture of when I did the oral argument before the Supreme Court. The decision was a 9-0 decision rendered in 34 days by the justices. Shannon Carter was a child with dyslexia who attended a school in South Carolina called Trident Academy, which is an Orton-Gillingham school, very similar to Kildonan, and I think they modeled much of their program after what is done here at Kildonan. And when I argued the case, in the audience was Roger Saunders. Now, Diana tutored me for 2 years in Washington, D.C., and in the summer between those 2 years, I attended Camp Mansfield, where Diana had previously worked. She was not there at that time. And my tutor, my counselor, my father figure was Roger Saunders. He was in the audience, and he kept saying to himself, oh, my gosh, I hope he took his Ritalin. Oh, my gosh, I hope he took his Ritalin. Don't fail me now, Peter. Don't fail me now. And in fact, on our website, we have a website, and it's called Wright's Law, just W-R-I-G-H-T-S-L-A-W, at wrightslaw.com. And if you just go in there and you just type in Saunders or you type in Supreme Court in the Google search engine, you'll find an article that was published in the Orton Dyslexia Society's journal called Three Generations of Dyslexia at the Supreme Court. Three generations, Roger, me, and Shannon. So that was in 93. And then from a legal perspective, what happened after that, we have a brand new federal law called No Child Left Behind. Was it really a brand new federal law? No. It was nothing more than the 2001 amendment to the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965. That's all that it was, with a fancy name. That's all. And people got upset with George Bush because he came up with this brand new law and rammed down everybody's throats. You really think George Bush, after he'd been in office for about a year, could have done all that at such high speed, given how efficient, you know, he was with other things? No, 1997, President Clinton, State of the Union speech. Look it up. We have actually on our website. But go online, and look it up, read the 97. He talks about the need for charter schools. Parents' right of choice if schools fail. That all this money is being paid by the feds to the school systems, but there's no accountability to see if the kids benefited. And reading is such an important thing, and it's gotten lost. That's where it started. The seeds were in 97. And the key, one of the primary keys of No Child Left Behind, i.e. 2001 amendment to the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, was targeting acquisition of reading skills. So those are kind of some of the legal developments. Both No Child Left Behind is up for revision, will be probably revised in the next 12 months or so, and this statute, IDEA, will be revised, I think, within just a few months there afterwards. Let me shift over now to a couple of other things here about what was going on with me. I've given you some background history. In the second grade, there were a lot of problems with me, and I'm going to show you, if we can get it up on screen, my report cards. Bear with me for a moment. When Congress passed the Buckley Amendment in the mid-70s, now known as FERPA, Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, I immediately contacted D.C. Public Schools and asked to get a copy of my complete file, and I was able to get the whole file. And so I'm going to show you the face sheet, the first page that anyone ever saw when they opened my file. Now, what is up on screen is the first page, and for those of you up near the front, you can see that this heading here says ability and character. I'm going to zoom in a little bit. Ability and character. And then this column here says special talents and desirable character traits that are well developed. The next column says special disabilities and character traits needing improvement. So my kindergarten teacher said I was sociable and self-reliant. But then she said immature, reversal tendencies, fussy, 2-3 with fists. My first grade teacher put nothing here because the kindergarten teacher took up two lines. Second grade teacher wrote anxious to learn, talkative, waste time, fussy. And then look what happened here for the third grade teacher. For those of you who can see it, look at this, what happened here? White out. No, it wasn't. Not in 50, that was in June 54. Nope. They had white out in the mid 70s when I got my file, but not in 54. So when they copied the file, somebody whited out that line. And then for the positive characteristic, you white out portions of the letters, making the word illegible. So it was a positive, nice thing said about me. I know not what it was. Fourth grade teacher wrote good mind, but waste time and disobedient. Now, they didn't use report cards in those days. They had progress reports they sent home. And so I've got just a few of them here. March 52. Peter's reading very nicely now. He's beginning to be able to go ahead in his workbook after the initial directions. He has settled down and takes care of his free time very well. When copying figures or words, he sometimes reverses them, but in general, he sees and produces them correctly. I am much pleased with him. June 52, Peter hasn't gotten back in the groove again since his bout with measles. He makes most of his numbers backward and seems to have forgotten most of the vocabulary he knew before he was sick. Perhaps he'll settle down again by fall. Since he has these, quote, reversal tendencies, I know it's hard for him, but he is successful when he makes the effort. So that was June 52. November 54, Peter's a very likable boy. He seems to enjoy school, interested in all his work. His reading is excellent. He is well-liked by his teacher. A note to my mother, we're very grateful to you for the interest and help you've given Peter. He has never enjoyed his work so much before. February 55, I am quite disappointed in Peter and his work, this report. He does not pay attention to directions and he has to be spoken to frequently for talking. Consequently, his work suffers. He has done much better work previously. April 55, Peter continues to disappoint me in his work. He does not do his best at all times because he does not keep his mind on his work and he wastes a great deal of time. For that reason, I'm lowering some of his checks. I hope he'll try to improve before the closing of the school as he is a capable boy. Well, capable boy. Now, it wasn't school closing, which he meant was summer vacation. A note to my father, we appreciate your conscientious evaluation of Peter's work and your understanding of him as a boy as well as a student. We are working on his shortcomings as best we can. We are working on his shortcomings as best we can. My father was a master at writing the mea culpa, we are so sorry, letters. I mean, he had to do that all the way through my sophomore year of college. What happened was, you saw that the summer, the June 52 comments. Around that time, my parents had a friend in graduate school, George Washington, taking some kind of a test in measurements or psychometric kind of a course and had to test children as a course requirement and asked permission to test me. My parents, of course, said yes. And I was given a bunch of different tests. And the way that one of the tests was explained to me was that the test had three subtests. There was test A, B, and C. On test A, my raw score number correct was much higher than expected for a child my age. It was about 2 years above expectations. Scored very well on that particular subtest. Subtest B, however, was quite different. My raw score number correct was much lower than expected. It was about 2 years below expectations. Now, if that test only consisted of A and B, and you put the two scores together, my composite, my cumulative, my cluster score had me looking normal. So if someone only looked at the cluster score, the composite score, they would say, oh, pretty normal kid. But in fact, the subtest scatter between A and B was quite significant. Subtest C was quite different. And the way it worked was when the youngster got five answers wrong in a row, five in a row wrong, you stopped and you added up the correct scores. And on subtest C, what happened was I started out and got two or three correct. Then I got three or four wrong. And she thought this was going to be just like B, but then I got one or two correct, then a few more wrong, a few more right, a few more wrong. And eventually I got five in a row wrong. But when I hit the five in a row wrong, it was way, way up there, much, much higher, quite a few years higher than expected for a kid my age. But the raw score, the number correct when added up, had me right in the normal range. And so subtest A, very high, B, very low, C, in the normal range. The composite, the cluster, the overall score had me looking pretty average, pretty normal, when in fact it was not. She took it back to the professor and said, I don't understand what's going on here. Had the professor double-check the grade, what she did. She did fine. And so what do I tell his parents? Well, you tell him you don't really know what's going on. It just doesn't quite make sense. There's something unusual here. Well, that's fine, but then, you know, that's not really going to be very helpful to them. What else do I tell them? You tell Peter's parents that they have got to go and get a comprehensive educational evaluation, a neurological evaluation, and a psychological evaluation, and hopefully by all of those, they'll be able to come up with what's happening. And my parents had a meeting with the evaluators and with the people that did the actual testing, and they said to my parents, Peter has a lot of problems, and we know what's wrong with Peter. Peter has trephocymbalia. And he also has an acute hyperkinetic disorder. Now, acute hyperkinetic disorder, the body of one of the reports, and I saw the reports, one of the reports said it was as if he had ants in his pants. He would not sit still. He kept getting up, asking how much more time, when are we going to have a break, and kept picking up things on the desk. And we had spent a lot of energy just keeping him focused on track. Over time, they changed the label from an acute hyperkinetic disorder to Mr. and Mrs. Wright. Peter has damage in the brain, but it's minimal brain damage. Then they changed the label to, well, MBD dysfunction, same initials. That he has a damage in the brain, but it's a dysfunction, really, because there's a deficit in some neurotransmitters and some chemicals in the brain, and some medications that might stimulate that could help. And over time, they changed it from MBD to what today, ADHD. And I was on meds intermittently, off and on, during that time. And the other part of the strephocymbalia, what do we do about that? Well, you have to find someone who has expertise in teaching children with strephocymbalia how to read, write, spell, and do arithmetic. Now, at that time, the school officials were telling my parents they thought I was quite possibly mentally retarded and very clearly showed all the characteristics of being emotionally disturbed. They did not put that in the report. They were trying to teach me how to read, write, spell, and do arithmetic, and I was absolutely illiterate, could not do any of them. And they were trying to teach me how to write with my left hand tied behind my back, tied to the chair, in D.C. public schools. And so my parents found Diana Canberry King. I ended up working with Diana for 2 years, one-on-one. And she told my parents at the end of the first year, Peter needs more than just working with me and just a focus on the academics. His problem is more pervasive, more global. He has difficulty with sequencing. And at that time, I'd get into the shower, wouldn't have the common sense or wouldn't think through ahead of time to turn the water on first before you get in. I get in the shower and I get confused, which was the hot and the cold, so I was either turning it on and freezing or turning it on and burning myself. And there were so many issues of sequencing and over, under, in, out, left, right, and reversal, spoken speech, and so forth that were going. So she told my parents that he needs 24/7 residential living setting, and here's where you send him, Camp Mansfield up there. Roger Saunders was my significant figure. And I came back and worked with Diana. And the way it was explained to me was the goal, Diana's goal was to get me up, not to age and grade level, but to get me 2 years above that. So I would never again ever have problems with reading, writing, arithmetic, and spelling. And I had testing again when I was in the sixth grade. And I was at the eighth grade level, across the board on all domains. She absolutely accomplished that. So I was a product of a really good quality intervention from two people who turned out to be basically the best in the world, Diana Henry King and Roger Saunders. And so that's why I say, but for Diana, I would not be here today. For my parents, my father was fresh out of graduate school. They were not wealthy. They did not have any independent source of funds. Both of their own parents had a lot of kids. So I had a lot of aunts and uncles, but that meant there was no money from the grandparents to help pay for tutoring and Camp Mansfield, Lean Durbrough's camp. And so my parents basically mortgaged away their economic future. I didn't understand that at the time, the economic impact on them, but it definitely had an economic impact. 2 years of intense remediation, but it certainly made the difference. Now, one of the things that I want to talk about is that Diana told my mother especially, don't lower your expectations. He is very bright, and you cannot coddle him. Don't feel sorry for him. Don't feel guilt. Be tough with him. Now, Diana, of course, is never that way herself with people, right? Be tough with him. And there was an instance that directly attribute to Diana talking to my mother that happened a couple years later. In the neighborhood, we just moved in a new neighborhood, and there were some kids that had been bullying me from time to time. And at one point, something happened, and I had three or four of them chase me several blocks. And I was fast. I could run as a sprinter. I could run pretty fast. But they chased me all the way to the house, and we had a screen door and then a regular door, and I opened the screen door real hard, bam, and opened the front door, bam, went in. And my mother was in the kitchen right off on the side from the door. What's going on, Peter? What's going on? What's going on? They're chasing me. They're going to beat me up. They're chasing me. They're going to beat me up. Oh, they are they? Yes. Well, let's just see about that. And she grabbed me by my belt in the back, opened the door, walked me out, took me out, opened both the doors, got me outside, and pushed me, and stepped back inside and closed the door. I'll tell you. Now, and what happened was, of course, those guys were standing outside, they just started laughing. I mean, to them, they couldn't have. And of course, that was a story, you know, about Pete's mom is worse than us. And yet at the same time, it also taught me that, you know, if I'm being bullied, I can't run home and tell my parents about it. And the next time an incident happened with one of the neighborhood bullies, I realized, you know, this is it now. And so I started yelling like a madman and charged at this guy, much bigger than me, at full speed, as hard and as fast as I could, knocked him down and started hitting him and everything else. Then the people jumped on me and beat me up. But those blows were well worth it, because I realized the value of appearing to not have all your marbles is powerful. They said, he's a little crazy. He's not hitting on all cylinders. And so I used to perpetuate that. I realized there's a lot of power in that. And so I perpetuated. In fact, I even did that as a lawyer. I realized at times, you know, coming in unpredictable, something was off the wall, catching people by surprise. Yeah, I don't know about Pete. You better be careful. He's going to come into court. He's going to have some little surprise in his pocket. And, you know, I don't know if it's necessarily something you would expect. At any rate, so I did learn that, and then I did get into one or two more fights later on with the bullies, And in each instance, the bully got at least a really, really good black eye. I might have gotten beaten up too. I don't remember all that part of it. But that certainly helped. And my parents never did lower the bar for me. Another thing that my parents did is when they had company over or meeting someone, my mother would always have me there, just around. And after they left, mom and dad would talk about the person and, you know, their impressions and what they thought or whatever, what it might have been. And my mother would then say to me, "Peter, tell us what you think. What do you think about this person?" And I would tell my parents what I thought. And my mother used to really rely on it. She used to brag about how, you know, Peter can really kind of put together what a person is all about. I don't know how he gets that gift and what it's all about. And let me go to Diana's book here. Dyslexic students possess keen powers of observation. They notice things and are entranced by their visual world. Absolutely. Nailed it. You know, there's a whole thing about the gift of dyslexia. And I became active in the LD dyslexia field when I was a juvenile probation officer. I went to Randolph-Macon College and got involved in juvenile justice. Between my junior and senior year, I lived on site at a juvenile training school 24/7 as a house parent. And then the following summer, I worked as a house parent and then later as a counselor. And then later I worked in the juvenile courts as a juvenile probation officer. And then it was 10 years later that I ended up going to law school. And when I worked in the courts, I ended up having a special federal program. I was able to create a federal grant where we had 15 kids in my program. We called it Mobile Probation and Camping, because we had a camping outreach program as a part of it. And there were 15 control group kids, and they randomly selected my program and the other program, and I got Virginia Commonwealth University Graduate School School of Education Special Ed Department to assign one student each one of my kids. And they got 3 credit hours for basically adopting, taking over one of my kids, and teaching the child how to read. That was the sole mission, not organizing the notebook, not anything, not even daily assignments, simply teaching the child how to read. Because we got comprehensive testing through Medical College of Virginia and most other court psychologists, and we found that for the average kid 15 years of age, and that was the average age for my kids, they were generally placed in the 8th grade and reading at the 4th and 5th grade level. So a kid's 15 should be in the 10th grade, but he's 15 and in the 8th grade, and he's with 8th graders and reading 4 years behind, what kind of things can you expect from that? Problems. I wonder if I bumped something up here. The volume seems to have gone out, but that's all right. My voice will hold out. And so we ended up getting individual one-on-one for each one of the kids, and the offense rate plummeted with my kids and remained the same and went up with the control group. These had to be serious offenders, not victimless crimes. And I really became impressed with the power of learning how to read as opposed to therapy, counseling for all your behavioral problems. And during that time, I had occasion to have a couple of youngsters that were at a school in Richmond called Stonewall Jackson, Barbara Geyer, Robin Barton, and Mary Louise Truesdell were working with the kids. And I met with Mary Louise Truesdell one day at the school, and she said, "You know, this child, Bobby, has dyslexia." And I said, "Oh, I know that. I read the reports and the evaluations. I understand that Bobby has dyslexia." And she said, "Well, you know what that's all, you know, that's about?" I said, "Oh, yes, I understand. I have dyslexia, too." She said, "Oh, yes, but, you know, lots of people had difficulty with reading and spelling when they were younger, but that doesn't mean they have dyslexia." I said, "Oh, no, I understand, but I have dyslexia, or I did have it. I mean, I don't have problems now, but yes." And she was poo-pooing it, you know, down. "Oh, yes, well, lots of people have these problems." And I could tell that she really didn't understand that I understood. And I said, well, my tutor was Diana King, and I went to Camp Mansfield where Roger Saunders worked with me. And her mouth dropped. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. You're one of the original first people under Orton Gillingham. Because this was back in the, I guess that'd be in the early 70s. And she pulled me into the whole going to the Orton Dyslexia conferences and the LDA conferences. And I did presentations about the relationship between reading problems and juvenile delinquency. And then later on, I went up the ladder in juvenile justice, became a bureaucrat, and found that I did not enjoy becoming a bureaucrat where I spin out red tape with my left hand and cut through it with my right hand, and issuing rules and regulations, enforcing them, and then finding ways around them, depending upon who I was working with. And I was no longer doing direct service, no longer working with the kids. And so many lawyers and judges had kept telling me I should go to law school. And my average was pretty much just barely graduated from undergrad, so I didn't think I'd get in. But I did get in, and I needless to say, became involved in doing special ed cases, and ended up representing Shannon Carter before the U.S. Supreme Court in the case that she had there. But one thing that really struck me was that when I was preparing for the Carter case for the oral argument, that was a nightmarish experience, the preparation for it. I had nightmares for weeks before. Once they announced that they were going to hear the case, the grand certiorari, I began having nightmares about it. I would wake up in the middle of the night visualizing myself at the Supreme Court arguing and looking down at my feet, and I was barefoot. Had no socks or shoes on. That was a recurring dream. I don't know. Some dream analyst could maybe tell me the significance of it, but it always happened over and over. And yet, all the while, if I did not have dyslexia, if I did not have ADD, ADHD, I would not have been able to do it. Because I think that in your process of overcorrecting for some of these characteristics, you develop secondary disabilities, like being OCD. Because my OCD mode kicked in, and I'll tell you, I mean, I perseverated ad nauseum. I mean, I knew every trial exhibit inside and out. I knew the transcript, hundreds of pages of transcripts. I knew it inside and out, and that really helped me go on and on and on. And I hunkered down for about 3 weeks. I said, no client telephone calls. I told all my clients I'm not going to be inaccessible and everything else. And I basically shut my practice down for about 3 weeks. And the thing about the gift of dyslexia, so many times this happened, and it's not related to being an attorney, but happened in the legal field always, and it's happened in so many other areas of life, there'd be a problem, there'd be an issue, and I would think about it, and I'd wrestle with it, and then something would come to me, and it would be just as clear as day. Ding. And I would lay that one on the table if it was like a committee or a team or whatever else. My God, that's awesome. That's incredible. How did you think of that? That just fits. I don't know. It just happened. And it's happened in so many areas of things that I do. And for the youngsters here in their room, there is a book. I ended up teaching law for 3 semesters in order to help William and Mary get a special ed law clinic up and running. And they got the clinic up and running. So now, thank goodness, I'm not doing it anymore, because that was a bear teaching law. The law students, especially the law. But one of the things we had our students read, our law students, and for all the Kildonan students here, there is a book by Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell is the author of The Tipping Point. There's another book he's got out that I like even better. It's called Blink. How in the blink of an eye you can come up with the solution, and you don't have to perseverate for weeks and weeks and have multiple committee meetings and come up with solutions, and how you must absolutely sleep on it. Well, you have to give it at least 24, 36 hours. And I kept relying on Malcolm Gladwell's blank to help me come up with a perfect theme for today, and it never kicked in. but at the same time, the whole issue of coming up with really, really good solutions is something that the dyslexic brain does have. And I was well aware of that long before I went to law school, and I attended a conference one time at the Orton Dyslexia Society's annual conference. There was a speaker there who was talking about the dyslexic brain, and he talked about another historical neurologist who said that the dyslexic is the mutant of the future. The neurological mutant of their future, because their brain is devoted to some very, very exclusive, hard problem-solving kinds of things. And that's why so many dyslexics have become so famous and contributed to mankind in incredibly significant ways. And I heard that long before law school, and so I've been holding on to that one ever since. And I hope any later research doesn't disprove that theory. I like to think we're the super mutants of the future from a neurological perspective, going beyond that, both of my boys were legally identified as having LD, but with my oldest one, when he was about 2 years of age, and I could hear the reversals in the spoken speech of his Getty. And see the confusion over under and out, all the typical characteristics, and very early on got him a comprehensive speech language evaluation from someone who was already active with the Dyslexia Society, now known as the International Dyslexia Association, got a comprehensive evaluation, and that person said, absolutely, there's no question what's going on, you need to get some individual therapy for him. And I got that over the objections of my wife, not my present wife, I had another wife before then. And I got there over her objections. My own parents thought I was jumping the gun looking for something that was not there. My in-laws thought I was jumping the gun looking for something that was not there. And even my sisters kind of accused me of looking for something that was not there. But the only person that said I was doing the right thing was the speech therapist, who really knew what she was doing. And that was a major turning point, because early speech intervention is related in part to acquisition of reading skills down the road. And he did have some issues, and he was in special ed for about 6 months. And after I discovered that the person who was supposed to be teaching him all the basic skills really got fascinated playing chess with him, and they would spend their sessions, their time playing chess, I yanked him out of special ed. And at that point, I'd been doing a lot of litigation, special litigation, and had a lot of expert witnesses. And I ended up becoming, I never was Orton-Gillingham certified, never went through all that stuff, but I went ahead and became his tutor in all domains, reading, writing, arithmetic, and spelling, because I remember so many of the things that happened with me when I was working with Diana and also with Roger, that I'll never forget at Camp Mansfield trying to distinguish the letter W from the M. And it was a hot day, and we had some pitchers of water or Kool-Aid or some drinks on the table, and condensation formed. And it probably was Roger had me draw the letter W on a big poster board and then draw the letter M. And which one, if you poured the pitcher of water or Kool-Aid, would hold more liquid, hold more water, the W or the M? And then we, using two fingers, we drew it on the side. I drew it on the side of the big pitcher, the W and the M. I never again had difficulty with W and M, you know. Rotating them, reversing, flip-flopping them. And B's and D's. B, bat and ball. And holding your hand in front of you with a fist, sticking your thumb up. And a D, drum, stick. The drum and the stick. And so I remembered so many of these things. And so with my boys, with my oldest first, I got him through. And his biggest area eventually became arithmetic, math, and trigonometry, failing trigonometry, and realized he didn't really have a good handle on times tables. And we spent 3 months going through a stack of cards that got bigger and bigger and bigger. Because every time he missed one, had difficulty, I made that same card again. Right? So the frequency of the hard ones kept coming up, and we'd shuffle the deck and take about an inch every morning before school, do that. He got to the point where he knew his timetables just like that. I could be driving down the road and I'd throw out something to him. And he had an instant, he didn't have to think about it, just recall, just a repetition and the review. He ended up taking calculus. Son, why are you doing that? You've got this calculus. You're not supposed to be able to take calculus. Why are you doing that? He said, well, Dad, since I was able to pull trigonometry out of the file and got a B, he had an F going into the last semester, got a B out of it on the final, I figured I can handle it. And he did. And he ended up becoming an attorney and did not want to become an attorney. My youngest son was also classified as LD, but I never even shared it with the school system, the evaluations that I had. I simply knew what I had to target and what I had to hit. and we boosted those two weak areas up. And both of them, when they turned 11, and they had significant problems with written language, and I really couldn't do the cursive the way Diana does. You know, I didn't have that ability. But I knew the importance of getting the thoughts from brain onto paper at high speed, because when you're trying to write it out, and if it gets printing, of course, the fingers cannot keep up with the brain, and you get all behind and out of sorts. So the power of learning how to type, but not hunt and peck. Both my boys, the day they turned 11, had to learn how to touch type. It took about 3 months for each one of them, and they had to spend half an hour a day, every day, except for, I think it was maybe Saturday, when they... And at that point, Diana had come out with her books, the typing stuff, and so they had the manuals up there. And this was not with Windows. This was MS-DOS and WordStar. I mean, the old people in the world, no, that was not easy. WordStar, alternate KB, to bold something. So they both learned how to touch type when they were 11 years of age, and did all their written work then thereafter with touch typing. And then the second one later became an attorney also. And I did not want either one to become attorneys, but they said, "Dad, the only skill we ever learned was cross-examination." So things really turned out very well. One of the things that I had intended to do today was to tell some stories about Diana, but... And a lot of good stories that are out there. And I was talking to Pam, my wife, about it. She says, "Well, remember when Diana came down to Richmond and she was the expert witness in your case, and y'all were driving down a road somewhere, and I was in the back seat and Diana was in the front seat, and you were on the phone." In those days, the cell phones were those big bag phones. "And you were on the phone with the client. You were holding the phone like so as you're driving, but then you couldn't really drive and hold the phones. You did that, but you were taking some notes, and I'm left-handed. You were taking some notes while you're talking, and I really got anxious because I knew that you know, you were driving with your knee, and I knew Diana was really going to lecture you, and I was really worried about what was going to happen after you got off the phone, because if you're taking notes while you're driving and talking on the phone." And she said, "Peter, you are still forming the letters the way I taught you. I'm so happy. I'm so pleased." Nothing about multitasking. And I've talked to quite a few people about stories about Diana, and I really kind of wanted to share them, but then I've only got until 12:15, and it's 12:16 now. So I'm going to have to keep you all here a lot later. Or in the alternative, I'll tell you what I can do. Here's what I'm going to do. Page 101 of Diana's book, a letter that Diana received from one of her students, Sydney. "As I sit here and attempt to write a note to the most influential woman in my life, I find myself at a loss for words. What you have done for me is nothing less than miraculous. The confidence I have gained, as well as the school skills you have ingrained in me, will carry me well beyond college and far into the future. I wish I could express my gratitude in words. However, none seem to fit. Your friendship has helped me through the most difficult transition in my life. I now know there is nothing I can't do. I love you and respect you more than you'll ever know. Without you, I could not be me. For everything you have done and all that I will do, I want to thank you." Then, I thank you. To respond. Where's the power button to turn the mic off?
Anyway, yes, he was dyslexic. And I remember when he was 8, his parents said, "You have a new dentist. His name is easy to remember, Dr. Armstrong." Guess what Peter called him all summer? course. He drove his parents crazy. He used to go where the TV was on, and he'd say, "What's about that?" And his parents would say, "No, Peter, what's that about? And what's about that?" I do remember the Supreme Court story, because you told me at the time, and all I could think was better bare feet than forgetting to button something up. I think, you know, I managed to help a few thousand people, but Peter has been all over the country, all over the world, and probably millions.
No, Diana. It's a ripples in the pond. It's a ripples in the pond, and yours have spread so far and wide, starting with you and Kurt Goldman and what you all have done, and the students that you have produced and what they've gone on to do. I mean, awesome. We thank you. We all thank you, Diana. Peter, thank you so much. So I think we can all agree Diana was right when she wanted somebody here to speak on her behalf. Peter was the absolute perfect choice. I think... Is this on? Okay.
Can you hear me? Good, all right.
I think it shows with that work, the ripples in the pond, you know, these small steps. And Diana told this great story this morning about how we found Shirley Kokesh and the story of the mouse. And it's the little things. It's finding the right person. And for everybody here, it was finding this school that changed things. And I imagine, for those of you who know what Carter funding is, you know, this impact, you know, this decision by Peter's parents to find Diana and get that help and what that brought to all of us today. And it's the same with Kurt and Diana. That conversation that Kurt had on Parents Day back in 1968 when he said to Diana, "We can start this school." Those things just had a huge impact and literally has changed the lives of so many people. And it's inspiring. It's inspiring for all of us. And one person it inspired was Emmeline Smith, who's here with us today. She's a sixth grader here in the school. And she's here with her teacher, Marianne Chatfield.